Запад готовит информационную атаку на Россию.
Reporting coming out of Western media is such a caricature, demonizing Russia.
Фабрика троллей. Здесь сотрудники наполняют социальные сети про кремлевской пропаганды.
Кто сегодня выигрывает информационную войну? Мы или они? Вот об
этом. Russia. Large, endless, and amazing.
$500 million a year spent to get the Kremlin's message out. An army of trolls and a mission to influence foreign news coverage, the most widespread disinformation campaign since the end of the Cold War, and the result? According to a new poll on Global Attitudes, Russia's brand is in the toilet. The numbers are devastating. Globally, just 30% view Russia favorably. In Europe, just 26% do. By large margins, Russia is viewed negatively in almost every region of the world. And the only thing worse than brand Russia is brand Putin. Worldwide, just 24% trust the Kremlin leader. In Europe, just 15% do. So just asking, is Vladimir Putin's vaunted information war actually an abject failure? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me from Berlin, making his first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, is Leonid Bershitsky, a political columnist for Bloomberg View, founding editor of the Russian business newspaper Vedomosti, and of the Russian opinion website Slon.ru. Welcome to the podcast, Leonid. Glad to finally get you on.
Oh, thanks for having me. Hi.
Always glad to have you. And joining us from New York City is Michael Weiss, a senior editor at the Daily Beast and co-author of a widely circulated report on Russian information policy. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks for having me back, Brian.
Always glad to have you back. Leonid, you memorably wrote in a recent column that the estimated $600 million Russia spent on the information war might be spent just as wisely buying more $600,000 watches for Putin press secretary Dmitry Peskov. That one got a bit of a giggle out of me when I read it the first time, and actually I cited it in my blog. So in your opinion, Russia's information war was a complete failure?
Yes, I think the international part of it was. People are more inclined to trust their own homegrown local press than any propaganda broadcasts from pretty much a foreign power. So there's, you know, nothing surprising in the fact that Russian international propaganda through channels such as RT is not really working. The domestic information war has been a great success for Putin, though.
Yes, and that came out in the Pew survey as well, and that's something we want to get into a little bit in the second half of the program. Michael, I suspect you got a different view of this, having authored, together with Peter Pomerantsev, a widely circulated report on Russian information policy. What's your take? Because it seems the Russians aren't trying to win hearts and minds in a mass sense. They're trying to kind of do other things, disrupt narratives, introduce doubt and confusion. What's your take on this?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it was never, information warfare was never about inflating Russia's stature in the United States or getting Americans to like Russia. I mean, you'll recall during the height of the so-called reset policy, which was a period of relative equilibrium in bilateral relations, Russian state-controlled radio was describing Hillary Clinton as a trucker lesbian within 48 hours of Mike McFaul's arrival to Spaso House as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. He was being compared to a pedophile and being branded a CIA agent and all the rest of it. These are not things designed to engender high favorability. But, you know, the real purpose of information warfare as conducted by Moscow has been to divide and weaken the West, to turn it against itself, to cultivate that which is freely occurring in nature, which is to say conspiracy theorists and cranks, be they on the far left or the far right, who, and this is in slight opposition to Leonid's point, do not trust their homegrown press and certainly do not trust their own governments. So channels such as RT, which is, of course, the heavily funded English language propaganda organ of the Russian government, it looks to exploit these weaknesses. It looks to try and atomize and polarize political opinion in the West. To that extent, I think they have been successful. If you look at the proliferation and indeed the rise of what I will generously call sort of marginal or outlier political parties and personalities and phenomena. I mean, you know, Syriza in Greece is a prime example of this. This was a party that was heavily promoted by Russia. That's not to say that Greeks voted for the party because of Russia, but, you know, there was a compounding effect or a kind of, an increase in the momentum. Jeremy Corbyn, the man who now stands to be the leader of the British opposition, the Labour Party, I'm actually editing a piece right now by another expert on disinformation who has done an analysis of how RT has covered Corbyn. And you know, Brian, that, you know, RT has a very prominent perch in England.
Yes, it does.
They have for years been trying actually to cultivate the Tory party with relative success, although now, thanks to Ukraine and other attendant crises, namely the designation of London as the world's hub of money laundering, the Conservatives have jumped ship. So now they're looking to Mr. Corbyn. And the analysis I see before me is that his mentions on RT, there's 85% positive mentions of this guy who, you know, has been accused of consorting with anti-Semites and Islamists and all the rest of it. And all my friends in the Labour Party think that this is the destruction of their beloved party. It's this sort of tea partyization of British politics. Russian propaganda is eating this up. This is exactly the kind of guy that they'd like to see, sort of shadow PM, and if not PM. He wants to pull Britain out of NATO. He's deeply distrustful of the, quote, official narrative propounded by the British government on everything from Syria to the war in Ukraine. He has endorsed RT as a neutral and objective source of information and news with respect to the Libya conflict. So again, we have to sort of establish what the premise of disinformation warfare is. It's not to get people to say, you know, such as, you know, Pat Buchanan here in the U.S. that, you know, we like the cut of Mr. Putin's jib. I mean, he's a conservative. He knows how to take care of business. He's not afraid of using military might to advance political ends and so on and so forth. That was never going to happen. They'll take what they can get in terms of any kind of, sympathetic or dare I say, fifth columnar support in Western societies. But the purpose is, you know, get people to question what happened on 9/11. Get them to question or doubt what happened in East Ghouta, Damascus in August of 2013. And indeed, get them to question what's currently unfolding on European soil. And Leonid is absolutely right. Domestic opinion in Russia has, I think, been catastrophically successful with respect to propaganda. Mm-hmm. I know well-educated cosmopolitan Muscovites, according to my Ukrainian friends, one of whom worked in the presidential administration under Poroshenko. She went back to Moscow at the height of Euromaidan a little over a year ago and said all of her friends there were telling her, Anna, how can you live in Kiev? It's being overrun by Nazis. What are you doing? Come to Russia. We'll take care of you. She'd never heard such madness before. That might be a bit of a, you know, sort of extreme example. But the fact that there are examples like that and they're increasing all the time. I mean, I don't put much faith in polling in Russia because, as we know, that's rigged. And, you know, the environment is so heavily mediated that the polls are naturally going to tend toward
polls are better than ever. I mean, others, Levada sure. is a much more reliable pollster than Sion, exactly. For example.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of clearing my throat by saying that because my point being that, you know, Putin is now above 85%. What is that if not mission accomplished?
Right. Now, but haven't you noticed, and especially lately, that I did a bit about this in my daily vertical today, that the efforts are getting kind of clumsy. I don't know if either of you saw this video that Komsomolska Pravda put out, purporting to show two CIA agents discussing how they were going to shoot down MH17 and use the incident to discredit the pro-Moscow separatists in Ukraine. This thing was comically bad. I mean, those are the exact words Foreign Policy magazine used, and I think they hit the nail on the head there. Because it was, I watched it the first time, and I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, it started, these are supposed to be two Americans, right? One of them start talking in the beginning with a British accent. And by the end of the conversation, he's using an American accent. So you had the accent switch in the middle. It was the language they were using, it sounded like they translated Russian to English with Google Translate, right? I mean, they were just using Russian formulations, and it just was so clumsy and so awful that I don't even see how this could convince Russians. But do you see their efforts getting clumsier of late?
I think they're not getting much clumsier than they used to be. I mean, this particular effort that you are talking about was meant for a domestic audience. It ran in Komsomolskaya Pravda. It's a Komsomolskaya Pravda exclusive. And, you know, Russians who listen to this, they basically, you know, they read the subtitles. They don't care about the British or American accents. They don't care that these are, you know, actors hired off the internet to read some text translated by Google Translate. It sounds genuine enough to the readers of Komsomolskaya Pravda, who are, you know, already converted to the Putin cause, pretty much. I just don't think the quality or the clumsiness or lack thereof of the domestic propaganda is even an issue. It's just, you know, the domestic part is done by brute force. It's coming out everywhere. It's just convincing by dint of there being so much of it. As for the foreign part, that needs to be, you know, more subtle and better done. But if the purpose is to divide and to, you know, sow doubt, as Andrew has been saying here, then how do you measure those results? If it's not the favorability, as in that Pew study, how do you measure success? By the, you know, by what the kooks say, the conspiracy theorists, the, you know, the extreme right, the extreme left? This is basically not measurable. And if you talk about, you know, the success of various radicals like Syriza, you know, Syriza came to power, and there were a lot of expectations in Moscow about what it was going to do to the sanctions that the European Union has against Russia. But then Syriza didn't do anything about them. It voted with the rest of the EU. You know, any hopes that they might have for the other radicals and crazies and extreme right and extreme left activists, you know, are basically just in, you know, in those Kremlin heads. They're not real in any sense. And you know, those people were around before RT, and they're still going to be around if, you know, RT folds. There's basically no way to assess the success of this effort, because the favorability ratings are the only stats available, and they're really bad.
Michael, actually, Leonid raises a good point here, and it's something I did want to talk about, because we got two kind of battles going on right here. You have the big battle, the macro picture, the battle for hearts and minds, and that's what we see in the Pew study, and we see it's a battle that Russia is losing decisively. But then you got this micro narrative battle, the one you were talking about so eloquently before, this battle to confuse, to distract, to disrupt the narrative, to sow doubt. Russia is doing well in that battle, right? Because among what we would call in the West, low information media consumers, I guess, to play in, you get a lot. I hear it here in Prague. Well, you know, we're not really sure who shot down that plane. I hear it from people who are otherwise well informed, but if they're not paying attention to this story the way we are as professionals, they get all this information and there's enough confusion out there. But my question, and this is the thing Leonid's raising, is does that matter? Because is that deliverable? Are there any deliverables there as a result of that? Is the micro narrative possibly overrated?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, I remember reading a few months ago in Politico, it was a piece by a Polish journalist who had said, you know, within the EU. Now, we can talk about the lack of favorability toward Russia in all these European countries. And actually, as I was telling you before we went on, the 70% disfavorable view in Germany really shocked me, because I always accustomed to thinking of Germany as sort of, you know, built on this foundation of Ostpolitik and, you know, having this relationship with the Kremlin that goes back to the Cold War. But that does not mean that Europe is united, or that Europe wants to really pick a fight or confront or contain or even really economically vitiate Russia. And, you know, the proof of this is in the fact that, yeah, we currently still have sanctions. They've been renewed, but they haven't been as hard-hitting as some have advocated. They haven't been as hard-hitting in Europe as they have been in the United States. And I think the reason is one of the aspects or one of the key props of this disinformation and propaganda campaign, at least as Peter and I put it in our report, is the use of money and the exportation of corruption. And, you know, the goal here is to make everyone complicit in the regime and in the system in Moscow. And, you know, European countries do not, frankly, they don't care enough about Ukraine. And I would even, you know, sort of hazard to say they don't care enough about Article 5 of the NATO Charter to really forfeit the economic incentives of kind of returning to a status quo ante with Russia. We see this in the Minsk II ceasefire agreement, which has been violated so many times and was violated first literally within hours of it being signed. And, you know, just in the last 48 hours, you've now seen another escalation by the Russian-backed separatists where they're even shelling Mariupol, which is the sort of next prospective hotspot that might be attacked or if not annexed. So I do think these what did you call them, microaggressions?
The micro-narrative battle versus the macro-narrative battle. I pulled that one out of my hat.
Yeah, I do agree with Leonid that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to sort of judge these things. I mean, what are the metrics here? But, you know, I don't think that a poll saying, you know, do you think Russia is a nice country or not is really dispositive. I mean, I think there's so many other things going on. You know, billion euro loans being issued to Le Front National, which is a contender. These are not, you know, I mentioned before what we used to confine to sort of the margins or cast off as crankish outcroppings of internal or geopolitical, you know, crises, such as the 2008 credit implosion. Now we have to take very seriously because these groups have been contenders over the last 5-6 years, not just Syriza, Podemos in Spain, I mentioned Le Front National, Jobbik in Hungary, members of which have been accused by the European Union of spying on behalf of Russia. I mentioned the efforts in the UK where I lived for 3 years to try and cultivate the Conservative Party and to solidify ties between Moscow and London, particularly at the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. You know, the UK just booted out of the Russian embassy three Russian so-called diplomats, one of whom is undoubtedly an SVR agent who is responsible for founding a front group called Conservative Friends of Russia, which was designed to do exactly as I say. Now, these things have come a cropper, it's true, and largely because of Ukraine and other things. Look, you know, Russia, when it at the UN Security Council, when it vetoes you know, the prospect of having an independent tribunal try to establish a sequence of events and the basic empirical facts of how MH17 was shot out of the sky. Had Russia come out immediately and said, you know what, the separatists did do this. It was an accident, though. We can prove it's an accident, and we beg forgiveness, just like the Americans had to after they shot down an Iranian plane and all these other innumerable examples.
And like the Soviets had to after they shot down an American or a Korean plane.
Well, yeah, but people would have been still down on Russia, but at least they would have said, okay, they've copped to it, and now they have to pay reparations. Instead, Russia has become a criminal after the fact by trying to cover up this horrible accident, if not this atrocity. And so when they veto a tribunal, the world looks on and says, what is this if not an admission of guilt? But while they're doing that, what else are they doing, Brian? I mean, you mentioned this sort of farcical, cobbled together CIA audio file. Well, as against that, I remember leaking conversations by Tori Nuland where she said, right, F the EU,
right,
or by the Estonian foreign minister in conversation with Catherine Ashton. These kind of classic KGB-style active measures, they're not so easily dismissed as ridiculous, and they do have a palpable impact. I mean, there are people today who believe that Tori Nuland is some kind of shadowy agent of the New World Order trying to destroy Europe and also take over Russia militarily, politically, and you know, in every other which way. You know, this is bonkers.
It's asymmetrical warfare in a sense. I mean, because Michael, you're really broadening the aperture here and moving it beyond the information war into the asymmetrical warfare place. And that's
all part of the same thing.
Exactly. Now, Leonid, what about that? Is Russia being successful in this broader sense of waging an asymmetrical war against the West?
Well, it's I thought we were talking about information and propaganda and stuff like that, and not about intelligence operations and intelligence, counterintelligence, all these fronts that these services set up for each other, the diplomatic efforts to or quasi diplomatic efforts to subvert politicians in other countries. There's all that going on, and probably, Russia's not the only country that does this. How successful these efforts are cannot be measured by any polls, but perhaps by, all sorts of international negotiations and agreements that come out to them. In terms of, Russian efforts to get a political support base in the West, these efforts, judging by the results, have been spectacularly unsuccessful, given that there are sanctions in place. There's a sense of isolation that the people in Moscow are denying, but it's definitely there. There are problems with investors. There are problems with getting the West to force Ukraine to keep up its part of the Minsk deal, because basically Russia is seen as the aggressor and as the party that is in the wrong here. So the West is not leaning on Ukraine to keep its end of the bargain. There are all sorts of indications that Russia hasn't been successful in the asymmetrical war, just as it hasn't been successful in the outward bound propaganda effort.
No, this is something. Actually, I was having a conversation with a colleague about this earlier today. And Michael, actually, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because this reminds me, there's a little bit of deja vu here. Rewind to the Cold War, right? And anybody that paid attention to the intelligence aspect of the Cold War, the espionage war, that time's functional equivalent of what this all is now. The Soviets kicked the West's butt in that area. They beat us hands down in the intelligence war. It didn't matter at the end of the day. It just didn't matter. And I'm wondering, are we looking at an analog here? The Russians might be, just running rings around us in this information war, and at the end of the day, it doesn't mean jack.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the sort of halcyon days of Oleg Kalugin, kind of running Phil Agee and doing all these sorts of things at a very sophisticated level, they might indeed be over. Where they lack in subtlety and, shall we say, kind of, high level tradecraft, they make up for in quantity. I mean, one of the things that Peter and I argue is so-called active measures have now become easier to do because they've been mediated. Right. I mean, all you have to do is find some crank sitting in his mother's basement who believes that, space aliens have, colonized the mind of the Pope, or have, the rebels gassed themselves and then filmed their deaths in Damascus, and all this sort of nuttiness, all of which, by the way, is, amply available at RT. Or that, for example, the CIA invented the Ebola virus as a form of biological warfare. You just have to find these people and give them a platform, right? In the past, the KGB would have to cultivate a journalist. They'd have to get that journalist to plant a story that they had concocted in some obscure newspaper, and then sort of work the organs of media to ensure that that story became bombinated around the world and became sort of part of this sort of marginal yet still somehow significant counter narrative. I mean, the most famous being the CIA killed Kennedy. Today, this stuff is done with the stroke of a pen or the click of a mouse, and it's easy because you don't need to spend that much time. But the farcical examples that we adduce. I mean, by the way, all the counter explanations or conspiracy theories about MH17, some of them don't withstand a 6-year-old, sort of grade school scrutiny, right? They're self-evidently implausible. But that's not the point. The point is, when these things get put out there, they have to be debunked. They have to be refuted. And the act of debunking and refuting them takes a lot of time and energy and effort. I mean, I know because I've done it myself. I mean, look at poor Elliot Higgins at Bellingcat.
Right.
Every single explanation for how MH17 was shot out of the sky, except the correct one, which he's also established, he has to engage with, or he feels he has to engage with. Otherwise, you know, the other side can say, well, you see, you don't respond to our argument, therefore you don't have true faith and confidence in your own. That's the tactic. It's really about grinding down, wearing down opposition and making it impossible. I mean, we, you know, they're outspending us on information warfare much as we outspent them on military buildup and escalation during the Cold War. And that's because it's just easier for them to do. You know, and I do agree with Leonid. I mean, some of this stuff does not meet its target. You know, I've seen internal RT memoranda which show that the top watched YouTube videos, you know, RT makes a big deal out of its online sort of click rate. The top watch YouTube videos for RT have to do with metrosexuals and bums and very little to do with Vladimir Putin or what really happened in Libya or what really happened in Syria. That is not terribly successful in terms of propagating an official narrative. But again, what is the mantra of all of these sort of state propaganda organs? It's not that there is verifiable truth. To say that Russia is a great country, you know, proud nation, fatherland, autocracy, and orthodoxy, and all the rest of it, that is a positive message that has to be put forward. That's not what they're trying to do. Rather, they're trying to put forward a negative message about everyone else. You know, Russia is encircled and attacked on all sides by this hegemonic, unstoppable Western sort of force. And here's what's really going on behind the scenes. Here's what they don't want you to see on CNN or the BBC. So it's sort of death by a thousand cuts. Now, again, how do you measure these things? You know, short of finding tomorrow that somebody who has been elected the, you know, chancellor or prime minister of a European country is in fact a Russian agent, I don't know that you're able to measure it. But again, look at the political sort of effluvium, if you like, that has actually become now very, very mainstream. I mean, you know, in the UK, the SNP lost the Scottish referendum vote, something that was very vigorously backed by Kremlin agents, right? But they took all of Scotland. So that's not a bad consolation prize. And the SNP's policies on everything from foreign policy to defense and the rest of it are very much in keeping with Kremlin interests. Not to say that they're a Kremlin, you know, run party, but this is what Russia has been able to do. So confusion, so doubt, so skepticism about one's own country, such that the alternative, Russia or China or Iran or Syria, don't look all that bad, you know. That's the name of the game.
So what they're doing in a sense is like bringing everybody's negatives down. If you think of put it in the context of an American political campaign, you're bringing everybody's negatives down. But here's the thing, and this is one of this, you want to talk about what shocked me in this study. It wasn't Russia's numbers so much as the United States' numbers, because the key villain in Russia's information campaign across the board is always the United States, right? It's always the evil hegemon, right? Well, let's look at U.S. numbers in this. I mean, in Europe, 69%. In Latin America, 67%. In Africa, 79%. In Asia, 66%. The only region in the world where the United States has a bad rating is, not surprisingly, the Middle East, where the United States has always had a bad rating. But in the Middle East, the United States has a higher rating than Russia.
Right.
United States has 29% positive rating. Russia has a 25 positive rating. Right. So it's not succeeding in bringing down the big enemy as well. I guess what I was driving at is that they could win this all they want, but in the just like in the Cold War, they were successful in the intelligence war. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Putin's boxed into a corner in Donbass. He's boxed into a corner at home between his nationalist base and the need to get sanctions lifted and get out of Ukraine. He's losing his energy card as oil prices fall and the energy market changes. So he seems to be losing on every front, regardless of how well they're doing on this.
but he doesn't behave as though he is losing. This is the crucial point. I mean, any day of the week, I open a newspaper and I see, you know, this is what the West doesn't get about Russia. So, you know, Mr. Putin is not a sort of clever Machiavellian mastermind, according to Mr. Kratsev in the New York Times. He's not even in control of the government. He doesn't want to be bothered. He took Crimea. That was his personal decision. But everything that's happening in the Donbass, he's sort of outsourcing to different Siloviki factions and fiefs in Moscow. Look, I don't know how people claim to know these things. You know, if they're being told these things,
he was like, citing Pavlovsky. He was right.
But you know, and fine. I mean, I would cite Pavlovsky too. But you know, again, what is his source of information? You know, I don't trust anyone who claims to have sort of monopoly on what's really going on behind the scenes in Russia. There's still a lot of unaccounted for variables and facts. And you say that, well, they're isolated, they're boxed in, they're losing, the Donbass has become a quagmire. It's become a quagmire, and yet they're still sending weapons to their proxies. You know, I mean, behavior that indicate or a disposition that indicates, you know what, guys, maybe it's time to actually sort of de-escalate or ramp down the rhetoric and pull back a little bit. This is going to become our Vietnam, if not our second Afghanistan. I don't see any evidence of this. I see instead, you know, it's Mark Galeotti calls this the baked Alaska conflict, frozen in the center and then hot at the edges. But it's getting hotter at the edges all the time. And it's doing so despite, as Leonid pointed out, an economy that's completely in the toilet, low investor confidence in Russia, and this sense of, you know, a political sort of chaos that might come next. I mean, after Putin, who takes over? And when is the after Putin period going to come? Could it not be that a lot of the things that we're talking about, you know, sort of the big what ifs and the, you know, the attempt to try and parse you know, a sense of Russian insecurity or Russian misbehavior as the result of feeling slighted or economically encircled. All of this could, in fact, be a product of a very carefully planned information warfare campaign.
Yeah,
well,
right? this is the big PSYOP, the big PSYOP theory.
Yeah, or make them question, make them wonder what our true motives are. I mean, that is sort of classic Czechist mentality 101 here. So I'm not saying that that's actually what's happening, but I have to question, you know, how we claim to know, you know, oh, Putin really thinks this, or he, you know, he really wants to do X, if not for Y. Says who?
Bring Leonid in here for before we move on to the second half. Leonid, any thoughts on what Michael is saying, or anything you saw in these numbers that surprised you in the Pew survey?
Well, there is something. I think, first of all, that basically everything that is being, well, at least what the responsible media are writing about what's going on behind the scenes in Russia comes from good sources. You know, I've got my sources, and I know other journalists working in Moscow who have decent sources, who have, like, access to people in the know and people in regular contact with people on the Putin team. And that's exactly the same thing that happened with MH17. The stories that formed the public opinion, the Western public opinion on MH17 were journalistic stories that had great sources. They were reports in UK and US newspapers and news sites that were investigated, that were done by people who went to the area and talked to witnesses and who analyzed a lot of evidence. And these are the pieces that actually form public opinion and not the answers to the Russian fake narratives. The responses to the Russian fakes, they are an industry in themselves, but they don't really reach the mainstream press all that much. The mainstream press prefers to do it the way it always did it, by, you know, sending out reporters and investigating things. And this is how you actually counter, without responding in detail to the fake narratives, that's how you counter them, by reporting the hell out of these stories. All the rest of it, you know, all the attempts to actually engage with the Russian propaganda and to answer it with, you know, Western counter-propaganda, to use a Soviet term, I think they're mainly attempts to get budgets out of governments. The way it's done in Putin's Russia. But the West is not Putin's Russia. The West has like a real press, you know, free media that are doing a professional job, and that's why the numbers in that poll are what they are.
Michael, last word to you before we move on quickly.
Sure. Well, in having this conversation, one thing did occur to me of where I think Russia's information game has succeeded beyond expectation, actually. In the West to this day, even in the Obama administration, there is talk that Russia is a great partner in counterterrorism, right? We need their help to wage this war against ISIS. We need their help just broadly against Salafi jihadism, both in the North Caucasus and beyond, you know, anybody who might be connected to Kadyrov's Chechnya and so on and so forth. Well, I mean, Leonid talks about real good shoe leather journalism. Novaya Gazeta had a big piece 2 weeks ago about how the FSB in Dagestan is encouraging people, you know, militants to go off and to Syria and join some Islamist or terrorist organization because better that they fight over there than over here. And also, by the way, isn't this great retaliation for what the Americans did to us in Afghanistan? That narrative or that sort of factual basis, which, I mean, I've talked to people from Human Rights Watch, I've talked to other Russian journalists and experts who say, yeah, that doesn't surprise us at all. That does not penetrate. That's not being propagated in the West as something that actually maybe the FSB is not such a great partner in counterterrorism. Mm. Even though if you talk to former CIA or former FBI, no one can example a single case where there was really robust counterterrorism cooperation between the United States and Russia. Not a single case. So how did this narrative come about? It was sold. It was packaged and sold. I mean, this is how Mr. Bortnikov gets invited to Obama's conference on countering extremism when our own FBI director wasn't invited to it. This is why he stayed off the sanctions list. So, you know, I think it is a bit too glib to say, sorry, but this whole effort has gone up in smoke. It hasn't. There are still areas, there are still, you know, sort of conversations or points in the debate where Russia is, you know, they're pulling the strings and they're also controlling and manipulating the way we think about them. That's the important takeaway. It's not about saying, yeah, you know, let's all listen to Tchaikovsky and read Tolstoy and what a great country, you know, what Mike McFaul used to tweet about when he was ambassador. That's not the game. That's never, ever been the game. So we have to take the premise for what it is. It's all about increasing the negatives and trying to sell Russia on this very transactional, pragmatic basis. Life will be much worse without our help than with it.
All right. Well, that's a good way to segue into the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at something else surprising that came out of the Pew poll and look at the growing psychological disconnect between Russia and the rest of the world and its implications. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me from Berlin is Leonid Bershitsky, a political columnist for Bloomberg View, founding editor of the Russian business newspaper Vedomosti and of the Russian opinion website Slon.ru. And joining us from New York City is Michael Weiss, a senior editor at the Daily Beast and co-author of a widely circulated report on Russian information policy. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
The Russian president's global image has taken a turn for the worst in the past year.
The strongest negative opinion of Russia.
In a new Pew survey, 43% of Americans believe Russia is one of the biggest threats to the country.
Americans' views of Russia have deteriorated.
America нас не любит. Англия нас не любит. Германия нас не любит.
In addition to showing the world souring on Russia, the Pew survey shows Russia pretty much souring on the world. Just 15% view the United States favorably, and just 35% view Germany favorably, for example. Leonid, the provocative headline for your column on this was "The World Hates Russia, Russia Hates It Back." And you concluded, I'm going to quote you to yourself, "Pew's numbers show how effectively Putin has managed to isolate his country and breed a siege mentality within it. His abortive attempts to improve his image overseas have ultimately served that same purpose." So we don't just have an economically isolated Russia. We have a psychologically isolated Russia as well. Leonid, what are the implications for this inside Russia?
Well, the psychological isolation is a precondition for weathering economic isolation. That's the way Putin sells the sanctions and Russia's economic troubles to the people. You know, he's basically, his propaganda machine is telling people that this is a huge conspiracy against Russia, and it's surrounded by enemies, and the Western powers are doing their best to crush Russia economically, and obviously you hear from, you know, there's plenty of quotes from Western leaders to support that, you can never put too much spin on this, and you know, we were talking about the sort of the brute force aspect of the domestic propaganda, and you know how much of it there is. So basically, if Putin weren't doing this, the entire the economic troubles that Russia has seen this year, the collapse of the consumer market, high inflation, now a second devaluation of the ruble is beginning, a fall in real incomes, the biggest one that Russians have seen under Putin, without anesthesia, without this huge propaganda effort, it might have been politically dangerous for Putin. He's sort of trying to make sure that people always know who is to blame, and he's succeeding in that because basically he has a monopoly on information within Russia. The few independent news outlets have much smaller audiences than the media machine that he's built since 2000, after taking over state television and radio and the biggest circulation newspapers, the news sites with the biggest audiences, and there's a lot of activity on the social networks as well. So he's just basically trying to make sure people always hear this message everywhere that Russia is fighting a war, and obviously when you have a country that's fighting a war, there's going to be economic difficulties, and if you don't understand that, you're not a patriot.
Now, Leonid, I'd actually like to get your opinion. I mean, do you expect sooner or later that the scales are going to fall from people's eyes? The objective reality of what Russians are living in is going to overtake and trump this information policy inside of Russia, Russia's information policy at home? Or how long do you expect this to go on? Do you expect people's opinions to change over time?
Well, this doesn't only depend on on Russians and on the Russian media. This is basically the West is acting hostile, perhaps of necessity, because it feels it needs to react to Russian aggression adequately. But it is acting hostile, and even educated people, even people who don't watch much Russian state TV and people who are not Putin supporters, they see that hostility. They sense it when they come to the West. Some of them interpret it as hostility not toward Putin, but toward them and toward Russia as a country. So this perception has some, it has certain roots in reality. So we can't really talk about the scales falling from people's eyes. This is not entirely a Putin concoction or invention. There's some rational, there's a rational element to this perception. So basically it would take an effort on the part of the West and perhaps a
you know, perhaps a softening on the part of the regime in the Kremlin for people to understand that this is not really a conspiracy, and you know, that it's not the U.S. that's causing the oil price to fall.
Right.
And you know that sort of thing.
So I mean, but are you saying the West should what ease the sanctions, not respond to Russian provocative moves on NATO's periphery? What should the West be doing differently that would?
There are things that you can do without without ending the sanctions or the justifiable defense efforts and, you know, the strengthening of NATO in Eastern Europe and the temporary basis and all that stuff. There are, friendly moves that the West could make, like, for example, visa-free travel for Russians, like things that would work for ordinary people, that would signal not enmity, but a friendly attitude toward the Russian people, as opposed to the regime itself. There could be, more efforts at, a meaningful cultural exchange. But like free travel would probably be, an extremely powerful tool. But nobody's talking about doing things like that. It's all containment and war on both sides. So it's easy for Putin to maintain the siege mentality because there is a bit of a siege.
What about that, Michael? Are we playing into Putin's hands? I know Mark Galeotti not long ago had a very thoughtful piece about this, saying that we should toughen the sanctions on the regime, but have a kind of a peace offensive to the Russian people in terms of things like visa-free travels, education and cultural exchanges. What about that?
Look, I mean, I would be more inclined to accept this proposition if it hadn't already been tested and shown to be wanting. I mean, again, we spent from 2009 until, generously speaking, 2011, maybe 2012. I mean, the United States prostrated itself to accommodate Russia, to show itself to be open to the Russian people, traditions, heritage, history of the country. I mean, again, this was actually one of the more beneficial aspects of the reset. This is not the Cold War is over. We don't have an antagonism with this great nation, and we want to increase bilateral trade. We want to have cultural exchanges. I mean, everything.
Sending Michael McFaul, one of the biggest Russophiles in the U.S., was part of that. To his credit, I say
earlier, it was greeted with a punch in the face. I mean, this was the period that coincided with the FBI spy ring, the Anna Chapman affair, Edward Snowden. You want to talk about, visa-free travel. I mean, how about you return a fugitive wanted American spy, and then we can talk about, allowing Russians to come over and, join junior basketball leagues or go on tours of Niagara Falls and so on and so forth. I mean, look, I think that the way to do this, I quite agree. I mean, all my Russian opposition friends say, look, we don't want the United States to talk about Russia. This is not a war on Russia, or this is not a policy aimed at the Russian people. We wanted them to talk about Putin and the Kremlin. You know, this is a distinction with a massive difference. It's like saying, Syria does not encompass the majority of Syrians who don't want to live under the Assad regime. The way to do this, I think, is to look at the one thing that resonates powerfully with the Narod. I mean, and that is corruption, the blind thievery of this regime and the way that it has immiserated large segments of its own population to enrich itself. I mean, Leonid talks about Peskov's $600,000 watch. This is the work that Navalny was doing. This is one of the reasons that, what the Kremlin billed as an inherently anti-Russian or Russophobic piece of legislation, the Magnitsky Act, actually had quite a lot of support within Russia, because this was aimed not at the Russian people, but against the corrupt, party of crooks and thieves. I've always said, even beyond sanctions, to me, I never thought sanctions were going to change the calculus of Putin and certainly not end the war in Ukraine. But the benefit to sanctions, especially for a journalist like myself and to other journalists in Europe and Russia, is the information warfare that is conducted in the passing of them. So, for instance, when the Treasury Department says, we believe that Mr. Putin has assets in Gunvor, a Swiss commodities trader.
Something journalists have known for.
Yes, but that enables everyone to rush out and now investigate and sniff around Gunvor and its you know, sort of shell companies and all of its assets and holdings, and to do more of this kind of, you know, blockbuster work. We've seen some of this being done, by the way. The New York Times had a big exclusive story on Bankrosia, the Time Warner Center, and all the kind of dodgy characters buying up real estate in Manhattan. This is the kind of thing that can be done. I've always said if Obama got up in the beginning of the Ukraine crisis and said, just even made a call to Putin, you have 48 hours to pull your weapons and your proxies out of Ukraine. If you don't, I'm going to give a press conference. And in the press conference, I'm just going to name the SWIFT transactions, the shell companies registered in the Cayman Islands and the BVI, you know, all the offshore money laundering jurisdictions that belong to both you personally through your intermediaries and your bagmen, and also to the people that keep you afloat, the businessmen, the Siloviki, the oligarchs that have kind of sustained, you know, the sort of wealthiest 1% in Russia. I think that might have had a bigger impact, frankly, than, you know, putting all these sort of quasi-structural but not really sanctions in place on Rosneft and Gazprom and the rest of it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the one thing that does matter in terms of objective or empirically verifiable truth to this regime is money, right? You know, in a sense, it's been more difficult to wage any kind of war against Russia at the information or political level today than it was during the Cold War, because Marxism-Leninism was intelligible. You could break it down. You can understand the ideology. There is no ideology today. It's just dollars and cents. Exporting corruption, buying people off, increasing investment because you know that people want to make, you know, as much money as possible. And it doesn't matter how blood-soaked money or dirty money.
They operate like a crime syndicate, in my opinion.
Exactly. And that is one thing that actually the United States can do that I think will appeal to the vast majority of Russians, because, you know, many of them are aware that they're being robbed. That, you know, they understand that corruption is the cancer eating away at this regime. The regime itself says it. You know, I mean, Medvedev campaigned on this. Well, campaigned, I put that loosely, but you know what I mean. I mean, Putin himself has talked about this war on corruption, except it's waged in a very Potemkin and sort of non-meaningful fashion because, you know, the investigators or the people who are there to ferret it out are themselves guilty of it. But this is where the West, I think, can make a difference. Has to be more strategic in how it goes about it.
What about that, Leonard? On both points Michael makes here, first, in terms of the opening to the Russian people, we've tried that before and got punched in the face. I think he's kind of got a point there. I mean, the reset did seem to attempt that, and the end result was not very good for the West. And on the corruption thing, would that resonate with Russians?
Well, on the first point, I tell you, frankly, I disagree. Michael, I don't think he's tried to get a U.S. visa under the reset. You know, he's never been to the embassy from that side where the Russians come in. I mean, that, you know, the public face that the U.S. and other Western countries present to Russians, you know, through the, you know, consulates and embassies has always been pretty hostile. You know, I don't really accept the argument that I, as a Russian citizen, should, you know, bring back Snowden before I can travel visa-free to the U.S. I mean, I have nothing to do with giving Snowden an asylum. You know, giving Snowden asylum. This is the regime. That's where you make a distinction between the people and the government.
I agree. You do have to make that distinction. But my point is, you know, the United States doesn't undertake any kind of, dispensation or concession to a foreign country unless it gets something back in kind. So, I mean, you know, want to talk about visa restrictions being relaxed?
Well,
how come American journalists are being kicked out of
the country or to the people?
Well, the U.S. does visa-free travel in a reciprocal way.
Yes,
is Russia ready to give the U.S. visa-free travel to Russia?
I mean, Leonid, you know, I mean, if Simon Ostrovsky can't get a visa to go and report inside Russia, or if friends of mine who've been applying, you know, get put on in that sort of state of suspended animation where they're neither approved nor denied. I mean, if we put an end to that, I'm much more inclined to say, absolutely. I mean, let's have visa-free travel. But this,
Georgia,
this is the problem.
Canceled,
diplomacy is waged government to government.
Visas for Russians in 2010, I think it was, just when Russia introduced visas for Georgians. And it was, you know, a friendly gesture that actually measurably raised the public opinion of Georgia in Russia, and it raised the number of Russian travelers dramatically. People with Russian passports who could suddenly travel there without a visa, it flooded Tbilisi, and there were like, you know, the year after that happened, there were like 3 million Russian arrivals that wouldn't have happened if the visas weren't abolished. So sometimes this is not done on a reciprocal basis, and you know, people with the, you know, country governments with the smarts to do it have actually gained from it. But that's okay. I've got a U.S. visa now, so I don't really insist.
On the corruption what do you think? Michael makes about corruption.
On the corruption point, I totally agree with Michael, and I think the Russian people would enjoy seeing some of these Putin cronies, you know, property confiscated in the West, and some of them even, you know, held there. But the thing is, you know, the efforts have been announced, and officially both the U.S. and European countries are hunting for the assets of these sanctioned individuals, but they haven't really found anything, which is not the best PR for the Western countries. Either their investigators are incompetent and can't find the money, even though everybody in Russia knows it's there. Or there's no political will to really search.
Or it's very, very, very cleverly hidden.
Yeah, no, I think it's the latter, if I may say. I mean, I remember when we presented our report to the State Department, the one person who was resistant to this idea of, you know, sort of telling the truth about dirty assets and money laundering abroad and seeing what happens was the White House liaison to the State Department, who he himself was responsible in part for inaugurating and coming up with some of the early sanctions on Russian officials. And he said to me, well, the reason we don't come out with more is we're worried what Putin will do next. And my response is like, what, invade Ukraine? I mean, you know, at what point do you say worrying about his countermeasure or his response to some, you know, kind of active punishment or active rebuke is sort of a fool's errand? I mean, you have to respond to these things lest you be taken advantage of, unless you be, violated infinitely. I mean, so I think, yeah, I mean, look, this is, as I say, this is one area where the U.S. government actually has a role to play in being a country that abides by the rule of law and that believes that, you know, things like bribery and money laundering and murder for the sake of corruption are bad and should be punished. And I think Russians absolutely agree and sympathize with this. I mean, again, look at the poll numbers for Magnitsky. They steadily increased as it was being considered as a law. Now it is a law and it's never been enforced. You know, or the names have not been added to that list. You didn't even need sanctions as an executive order. You could have just used the Magnitsky Act as a vehicle for that. It was never done.
Although
political will is 100% correct.
Although we are beginning to see things change, and not just in the United States. I mean, the whole From Russia with Cash thing, and a lot of credit to Ben Judah for getting that thing rolling. We did a program on it a couple of weeks ago. That is opening eyes. And I'd be curious how that's playing inside Russia, or if people are even aware of it. But that's potentially explosive if that thing really takes off and you begin to expose the true extent of Russian money laundering in the UK and in the city of London and so on. But so the tide is turning on this, and this might be a potential area where we could see some progress, and we could see the West and the Russian people on the same page, perhaps. Leonid, last word to you, as I like to close off positive, and I just threw out a positive thing. So last word to you before we're getting up against the end here, before we wrap it up.
Well, you say the tide is turning, but again, I say, how do you measure that? You know, measured by the amount of assets frozen or the amount of, you know, the number of big Russian-owned estates confiscated, the number of fugitives caught. You'd say the tide is, you know, pretty much where it used to be.
Well, I don't know. By the mere fact that we're seeing documentaries on British television exposing the not just you know, Russian money laundering in the UK, but the complicity of UK estate agents in this case in that, I think is a sign that the tide's turning. Yeah, it's one example, but it's something that wasn't happening before.
No? Well, it was a nice story, but you know, it was basically just one. You know, one report on television. So I don't know. I mean, this really doesn't solve the political will problem. But certainly, I don't think that exposing Russian corruption and Russian money laundering in the UK or the US, where there's plenty of it for sure, is going to it can work as the only way of showing Russians that the West is not hostile. Catching a few of these thieves, you know, so some of them get caught in Russia as well. And this is usually the result of, internal struggles within the gang.
Right.
So, exposing a few of them is not going to endear Russians to the West. There's got to be, a more of a comprehensive policy for making sure Russians understand that it's their government, it's their regime that is isolated and that is being fought, actually, by the West and by the Ukrainians as well, not the Russian people, not the country itself. Otherwise, the domestic propaganda war, the domestic propaganda efforts of the Putin regime is going to keep being successful despite despite the economic problems, unless these economic problems really worsen so much that the propaganda is going to stop working and people are just going to take shovels in their hands and go storm the Kremlin.
And we have to wonder if it's going to get to that point. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it all up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me from Berlin has been Leonid Bershitsky, a political columnist for Bloomberg View, founding editor of the Russian business newspaper Vedomosti, and of the Russian opinion website Slon.ru. And joining us from New York City has been Michael Weiss, a senior editor at the Daily Beast, and co-author of a widely circulated report on Russian information policy. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and lively discussion.
Thanks, Brian.
And I'd also like to thank our producer, Jan Kaiser, for filling capably the big shoes of Tanya Koncheva, who's still on vacation. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.